3 years after Russia's attempt at regime change in Kiev, Ukraine, there appears to be no immediate peace process in sight, even though the U.S. president has spoken to Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's President Zelensky and European nations and made it clear that America will not keep endlessly bankrolling the war and that the war has to end now. Trump's European partners have rejected the proposal, saying Ukraine must be a part of its own future in talks and that this could not necessarily end overnight. What you're going to now see is an assessment of what some of the possible next moves are. This comes from Major General Mick Ryan. He's a retired Australian Army officer who's one of the foremost analysts of the Ukraine war. Possibility number one, talks stretch on indefinitely. Essentially, negotiations could drag into late 2025, stalled by Russia's unwillingness to budge and Trump's surprising tolerance for Putin's stubbornness. Both Ukraine and Russia would keep up military efforts to show strength and push for a big win, though such a breakthrough seems unlikely now. Another option, Trump fails to seal a deal, turns up heat on Russia, which means that Putin could be stonewalling, refusing to give up an inch until Trump runs out of patience. He might then ramp up aid to Ukraine in a bold Trump-style escalate to de-escalate move, which could force Putin's hand. That would be America's expectation. It means that America's support for Ukraine could keep flowing. That's what Kiev wants. That's what Zelensky wants. Another option, Trump strikes out, leans on Ukraine instead. Here the U.S. keeps sidelining Ukraine in talks that's happening presently, hashes out a deal with Putin, but Ukraine and Europe refuse to play along. America stays involved, though. What it means, Trump's pride could take a hit, prompting him to squeeze Zelensky economically while scaling back military and intelligence support. Now, Trump brokering a deal which is acceptable to everyone, that's the best case scenario, as long as it lasts. Imagine Ukraine, Europe, Russia, and the US agreeing to end the war for good. Not just a pause, this feels unlikely because American negotiators have leaned into Russia's version of the story and seem more eager presently to cozy up to Moscow than protect Ukraine. And finally, Trump throws up his hands and simply walks away, fed up with the mess, because wars are messy and ending them is perhaps messier. Trump could pull the U.S. out of talks, leaving Europe, Ukraine and Russia to figure it out. What it means, without America, talks would likely collapse. Well, joining us now is Ravi Agarwal. Thanks very much, Ravi, for being with us. Give us a sense, Ravi, of your initial belief about what's going to take place now at the White House, a crucial meeting between the French President Macron and Donald Trump. How important is this meeting?
It's very important. Look, I don't play the predictions game, but it's clear that of all of the European leaders, French President Emmanuel Macron has made clear that he sees himself as the kind of person who could rally European leaders to go it alone, to do their own thing, to create a European defense force, to try and negotiate the future of Ukraine, and to try and, more than all of that, chart a path forward for Ukraine, independent of the United States, not depending on it for its own security, for its own future. All of this, as you'll remember, you and I were both at the Munich Security Conference a week ago, led Macron to bring several European leaders together in Paris for an emergency summit. I imagine he's going to bring some of those concerns, some of those views to his meeting with Trump, while also trying to make sure that he doesn't further rupture the Europe-US relationship. I think European leaders are going to be very cautious in terms of making things worse, while still making very clear that they're unhappy with Trump.
The fact that Trump wasn't there to receive Macron personally, Macron got off his vehicle, walked into the White House, does that send a signal?
To some extent, but I wouldn't read too much into pomp and circumstance. Ultimately, that is not the substance, right? If there was healthier relations between the United States and Europe right now, we wouldn't be reading too much into that particular snub. I think much more important than that, Macron is going to want to convey to the United States that European leaders are very upset. I mean, you were talking earlier about the potential new German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, who made very clear in a TV conference that he is shocked, surprised by Trump's approach towards Europe, and that the Europe needs to think about a future for NATO without the United States. These are seismic, dramatic comments that would have been unimaginable even a few months ago. So Europe is really thinking the unthinkable right now in a way that I think they will all be trying to convey to Trump. Remember, the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, also comes to the White House on Thursday. So this week, that will very much be the theme.
Let's just continue with this theme of America, in a sense, pulling the rug on Europe. You and I were both in Munich where J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, said, and I quote, "For years, we've been told that everything we fund and support is in the name of our shared democratic values. But I look at Europe today and wonder why the Cold War's winners had abandoned the values that let them prevail against tyrannical forces on the continent." Where does that leave so many European countries right now?
Well, obviously, they smelled hypocrisy with those comments. The United States has its own checkered record on democracy. This is very well known. January 6, 2021, which Vance is acutely aware of, in a sense, as one European foreign minister put it to me, Vice President Vance was trolling the Munich audience in that moment. And they know that. They realize that. Vance also met the leader of the far-right German party, the AfD, which, you know, was seen by many in Germany as really crossing a line, giving credence to a party that is seen as, you know, way too far right, despite the fact that it has won about a fifth of votes in the election on Sunday. But all of that, I think, is of a piece with Trump's approach to Europe, trying to make clear to them that it's my way or the highway, this sort of tough love approach. But I'll remind you and your viewers that the only time NATO's Article 5, which is the rule that you attack one of us, you attack all of us, the only time it has ever been invoked was right after 9/11, mm-hmm. when Canada and European countries came out in support of the United States. The fact that European leaders are now saying we need to think about NATO without the United States is seismic, as I said earlier, and it should worry American scholars.
There's also the other strand of the right in some parts of Europe, being increasingly pro-Trump in a sense. I mean, if you look at what the Italian Prime Minister said yesterday, and again, let me quote, "When Bill Clinton and Tony Blair created the global leftist liberal network in the 90s, they were called statesmen. Today, when Trump, Meloni, Milei, or maybe even Modi talk, they are called a threat to democracy. This is the left's double standard. We are used to it. And the good news is people no longer believe in their lies, despite all the mud that they throw at us." Now, Italy is a key military partner of all of the other European nations, particularly in the context of Ukraine. If the Italian Prime Minister is saying this, Macron and Starmer are saying something else, the last German chancellor, on the side of liberal democracy, then again, is this not a mess within Europe?
Europe is fracturing. I think there are certainly moves within Europe to try and find common cause, the common cause being security and defense above all else. But for a long time, we've seen the rise of the right in Europe, and much of that has to do with migration. I think Europe for many years now has been practicing a policy of open borders. There have been internal concerns about this having gone too far. And in many senses, the rise of the right in Europe is a response to that. This is also to some extent the proximate cause of the rise of the right in the United States, where the rise of undocumented workers coming into the United States led to a lot of criticism of President Joe Biden, and in some senses, you know, could have been one of the reasons why people favored President Trump. So for Meloni to say that, I think, is her way of finding common cause, of securing her own right credentials, calling out the left, which, you know, she has every right to do. The left also has had its own double standards. But I think on the question of security, I think her country would actually feel differently were NATO to actually have to go it alone at some point. So there are fissures here. It's not like Europe can agree on this equally.
In the immediate run, is it your sense that there will be no peace process? It is going to take time. There are huge differences between Europe and America, and therefore, in the interim run, we'll see the war continuing.
It seems like it. I mean, today is the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Last night was devastating. Russia continued to pound Ukraine with drone attacks, including in Kyiv. And you can imagine that this would continue until some sort of a ceasefire and then a peace deal and then security guarantees are reached. We have no clue at this point as to when that might happen. Trump, of course, has been trying to do what he says is brokering a peace deal. But if you exclude the Europeans from this, their point, every time I've spoken to a European diplomat, their point is clear that ultimately they're the ones who are going to have to defend the border, the Ukrainians and the Europeans. And if they're the ones who have to defend whatever new border is created, you can't leave them out. And, right. You know, were Trump to continue leaving them out, we'll just be left with a deal that they won't accept. So for forward momentum, they'll have to be included.
All right, Ravi, wonderful speaking to you. Thanks very much for being with us. We're going to continue this conversation, look at, a peace process, whether, it's at all on the cards right now, despite what Donald Trump says. I'm joined by Tatiana Kokreva, senior journalist, joins us from Moscow, and Olena Tregub, former director of the Ministry of Economic Development and Trade of Ukraine. I'm also joined by Dr. Mohan Kumar, India's former ambassador to France. Thank you all very much for being with us. Olena, to you first. It just seems that Donald Trump, for the moment, is willing to pursue a path he believes is towards peace without the active involvement of Ukraine. Ultimately, can Ukraine do very much about that?
Well, Ukraine absolutely cannot do anything about it because this is the decision of Donald Trump and United States. And they decide whether they want to have negotiation with Russia regarding some issues, not only Ukraine. Definitely they are discussing their security and energy in the Arctic and so on in El Riad. But what Ukraine can decide is, of course, Ukraine own national sovereignty, Ukrainian unity, Ukrainian resolve, and this has been very strong in the recent days. Ukraine absolutely is united country, absolutely independent, absolutely strong, even in the light of what Trump says.
Tatiana, just in terms of what we are seeing right now, the expectation on the basis of the conversation between President Putin and President Trump that there would be something immediate. Is it now your sense, and perhaps we should all get realistic, that look, nothing's going to happen immediately, that the war is going to continue for an indefinite future until such time as both sides get on the table? That's not happening immediately. That's the sense I get. What is your opinion?
Well, very much so, Vishnu. And if you remember, this is basically what I've been telling you all along. You know, we've spoken about this extensively. That
I was hopeful. I was hopeful it might end, but clearly, 1 week later, things have changed. Go ahead.
Yes. See, we are here in the northern part of the world, and we're not hopeful. We're realistic. It comes with the air temperature. It's in the minus degrees right now, so there is no hope for us. Look, this has been very clear from the very beginning. Donald Trump likes to talk, basically. He likes to make big declarations, and he thrives on the reaction to those declarations. And so, so to speak, Elon Musk is kind of the same. He's been so we have two people in this administration who are thriving off of the reaction to what they're saying. In the meantime, I think the biggest message we've finally heard today from the Russian Foreign Ministry, the Foreign Minister Lavrov has said that the fighting and the military activities will continue until such moment as Russia's conditions are met, basically. We are looking at a probably lengthy negotiation because, and it makes total sense because, we've had those negotiations before and we've made compromises. We made compromises in Minsk and we ended up basically, seeing every single agreement broken very, very soon. So we're not taking any middle ground anymore.
Okay. Dr. Mohan Kumar, there are two strands over here. On the one hand, there is the urgent need for peace, which we all agree on. We don't know how that's going to happen. That's the larger problem. The other one is the huge difference in the relationship between America and its closest NATO allies. Do you believe that fractured or that increasingly fractured relationship is going to define the pace at which we find a solution to this crisis, the war?
Thank you very much for having me. I think there is mixed messaging from Washington, frankly. And I have to be honest with you, Vishnu. I don't entirely share the view of many of your interlocutors that it's going to take ages before a peace agreement is reached. My sense is that there is already a report of some minerals agreement being signed between Ukraine and U.S. Ukrainian deputy prime minister has confirmed it. The U.S. has been saying such an agreement is imminent. Now the Ukrainian deputy prime minister says, yes, we have the details of a mineral security agreement. If that agreement passes muster, I have a feeling that it is also the fact that other negotiations are happening. I agree it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it is not my sense that this war will drag on 6 to 8 months or 1 year, because my sense is that Trump knows his reputation is at stake. He first said by way of bluff and bluster that I'll do it in 24 hours. Now he's saying we will try and do it. I don't think this war can continue for too long. So my sense is something is happening. We don't all have equal access to information, but I'm going by the Ukrainian confirmation today that there will be a security minerals agreement. And that for me is key, because it unlocks a lot of things in terms of U.S. relationship with Ukraine. So we will wait and see. The deal may not be to everybody's liking. I think it's clear to me that Russia will have no interest in pursuing this war if what Peter Hegseth and if Marco Rubio say Russia will get, if Russia gets that, there is no reason for Russia to prosecute the war. If I can get to keep my territory and if I can make sure Ukraine doesn't join NATO, everything else is negotiable, frankly. I want to get out of sanctions. I want to be treated like a great power. And if Trump can make a trip and meet Putin somewhere, I think that will unlock a lot of things. So it's not Russia which is the issue. What I do concede is that Europeans are extremely divided. And it's true that they are very angry and hurt. But there again, I see the UK taking a very different line from France, for example, or UK taking a different line from Poland, for example. Mm-hmm. Poland says no troops. UK says we will provide troops. So I think you're going to see a lot of churn, but it's my understanding that it is Europe and Ukraine that I think have to get their act together, sure, difficult as it is, to come to a stage or a position so that Trump can do something about this. All but right, that's my sense as an outsider.
Right. Olena, would you like to come in on the minerals agreement? Do you believe that is, the magic wand, as it were, that if there is an agreement that Ukraine has to sign or is almost forced to sign with the United States, that could unlock, a peace process, at least the start?
This agreement is absolutely not about peace process, and we can sign this agreement, and that would be our agreement with the United States, but the war will continue. The point of the agreement is that U.S. will keep providing assistance to Ukraine. That's the main point. And I just want to mention that two previous speakers, Madam from Russia and EU ambassador, you are very pro-Russian, both of you, and you don't think clearly. Do you remember that before you were saying that Ukraine, it's a puppet of United States, and this war only happened because U.S. provoked Russia, because of NATO, and so on? Right now, Trump says he doesn't want to support Ukraine in the war, and Ukraine keeps fighting. Today is the third anniversary of this invasion. Ukraine is brave, resisting for its freedom, for its independence. And it has nothing to do with US, it has nothing to do with Europe. We need free countries to support Ukraine, and we need people in India, like you, Ambassador, if you respect democracy and freedom, to respect Ukrainians. That's what I want to ask you before you start saying phrases like Russia is not a problem. This is just blows my mind, frankly.
No, I think I understand, Olena, you know, how difficult it is being in the middle of a war zone. But I do believe that, you know, India is entirely committed to the process of peace. We've got a stake in this in terms of a relationship with your country and with Russia. So I think Ambassador Mohan Kumar is entirely independent, and I think we're all in the, you know, we all want peace to happen. We just don't know the contours. But be that as it may...
By killing Ukrainians, what kind of peace do you want? Do you want justice? Do you want a fair world? Do you want a world where a free country can exist without being threatened from an authoritarian nuclear power? What kind of peace do you want? If Ukrainians are dead, there will be peace, but there will be all dead Ukrainians. That peace that you want.
Oh, my God. Oh, dear God.
All right.
Anyway.
No, Vishnu, I would very much like to come
it's
in.
It's okay. She's emotional, so I respect that. I'm just going to keep quiet. Otherwise, it'll get into a debate. Thank you. You're all entitled to your view, madam. I have to grant you that.
Tatiana, go ahead. We've got about a minute and a half left. Go ahead.
A minute and a half. Oh, damn. Olena, just as I told you last time, I'm very happy that we get to repeat this. Maybe one day you'll actually think of what I'm saying. If you wanted to be a free and independent country, you shouldn't have danced to the Democratic Party's fiddle. You shouldn't have flirted with the idea of the conflict that you couldn't possibly ever win. And Ukraine doesn't keep fighting. Ukraine keeps losing. So you have to stop talking with slogans that are out of date and have been out of date for at least two of these 3 years. This resources agreement is going to happen whether, you know, it depends on the conditions that you guys actually agree to, but it definitely is going to happen. You know, there's a saying in Russian, and I actually know it in Ukrainian as well. You know, it says that he who dines with the woman then gets to dance with her. You accepted money, and every money has to be repaid. Basically, that is exactly what's going to happen in this situation.
All right. Look, I'd like to thank you all very much for being with us. Ambassador Kumar, any last word over here? Do you potentially see a role for China, possibly even India, a third party, a third major power, in trying to sort of bring about some sort of peace?
Very briefly, Vishnu, I can only speak for India. I do not see a direct role for India. I see a role for Ukraine. I see a role for Europe. I see, obviously, the United States getting involved in the role of a mediator. I just want to say to my Ukrainian friend, while fully respecting her sentiments, we want the war to end. I am not saying it should be an unjust settlement, but I think if you don't talk to each other, you are not going to have a settlement. That's all I'm saying. We have to stop fighting. Enough lives have been lost. It's time to put an end to this war. That's all I'm saying. Thank you.
Professor, the war is coming from Russia. The war is not coming from Ukraine. The war comes from Russia. Russia has to stop.
No, but Olena, I think without getting into, you know, who started it, I think we can all agree that the killing has to end. I think that is something we
That's
all agree
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
I think we
Ukrainians,
all agree on that.
Ukraine, absolutely. No more than nobody wants this war to stop
sure.
more than us.
So,
believe me.
And I would suggest that Russia equally wants the killing to end. Nobody wants lives to be lost. Let's leave it over there. We're going to move away from this, take a short break. Coming up after that, we're going to resume the discussion looking with two experts at the changing relationship between America and Europe, and also specifically what some of the options are in terms of ending the war in Ukraine. What might just happen in the days ahead? That's coming up. Stay tuned. Well, somebody who's been observing Ukraine, the Ukraine-Russia war, and what the situation is very, very closely for the last several years, Shashank Joshi. He joins us now, the defense editor of The Economist. Thanks, Shashank, very much for being with us. We met a couple of days back in Munich, and there was a sense that something unexpected could take place with strong statements from J.D. Vance and strong statements from Trump prior to that. Nothing really has taken place, at least nothing that's resulted in the end of the war. So I'm going to throw out a couple of scenarios for you just to get your reactions on what may actually take place. Firstly, the possibility that talks stretch on indefinitely, led possibly by Putin stating that he wasn't willing to budge and accept any terms and conditions. Is this a possibility which would mean that, look, we would see even more loss of lives going forward?
Vishnu, I think it is a possibility. We know from all of the European and American intelligence assessments that the Russian government's objectives remain pretty maximalist. That is, the subjugation of Ukraine, no foreign troops in Ukraine, a neutralized, relatively disarmed Ukraine. You know the list. However, I will say that in the week or so since you and I chatted in Munich, America has given concession after concession to the Russians. The Russians will be delighted by the exclusion of Ukraine from the talks, the invitation back to the G7, the Americans pushing a resolution at the Security Council that makes no mention of Russian aggression. And so for that reason, I feel the Russians will feel pretty confident that they can get something out of this process, which makes it less likely that they will simply walk away from these talks. But we are a long way from any significant, serious, immediate haggling right now.
Could we see a situation where Trump actually runs out of patience unless Russia acts soon and then, potentially ramps up more support to Ukraine? This is unexpected, but I think Trump is working on a clock and he's impatient for results. What if that doesn't happen?
I agree. I think if you had asked me this a few months ago, I would have said that this is a realistic scenario, given the writings we've seen from people like Keith Kellogg, his Ukraine envoy, from Mike Waltz, his national security advisor, who wrote an essay for my publication, The Economist, in which he said, look, we're going to apply pressure to the Russians. We're going to push the oil price down. We will ramp up sanctions. We may arm the Ukrainians. Having said that, looking at Trump's approach to this, it is clear to me he has some degree of ideological affinity with the Russians. He likes strong leaders, whether they are autocratic or not. And he has a degree of contempt for the Ukrainians. We've heard how he has called Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's elected president, a dictator, how he is pressuring him for a minerals deal to hand over $500 billion worth of revenue from mining and other extraction. For all of those reasons, I am pretty skeptical, Vishnu, right now, that this is a president who is willing to seriously turn hostile towards Vladimir Putin. And that is why my colleagues in Europe, my peers in Europe, are so gravely concerned about what we are seeing from our European perspective.
What if Trump keeps on sidelining Zelensky and Ukraine, as he's done by and large so far, and then tries to strike out a deal himself? And then sort of presents it as, deal with Ukraine has to take it or leave it. And I see that actually as the present scenario. And one where you've got Ukraine supported by several European nations on the one hand, and Trump sort of going it alone in terms of his vision of the road ahead. Do you see this scenario going forward?
I agree with you that that is the most likely situation. But I think he has to be careful, because although Ukraine is significantly dependent on the United States for the provision of some key military and intelligence capabilities, things like air defense, for instance, if a deal is so lopsided and so punitive and includes no serious security guarantees, for Zelensky to sign it would be signing his political death warrant. It would provoke unrest within Ukraine. It could even prompt a coup within Ukraine. The military would not necessarily go along with it. Similarly, for Europeans, European states could not go along with a deal, for instance, that legally handed over 20% of Ukraine to Russia, a forcible change of borders in Europe. We couldn't do it. Europeans couldn't do it. In that situation, Zelensky, although he would pay a very high price, make no mistake, could absolutely walk away from the table, and he would have to then deal with the consequences. Europeans could provide some aid. They could not make up the entire difference, but they could provide some aid to keep him in the game. That is eminently a possible situation right now.
What if Trump were to actually broker a deal, one that everybody accepts? Is that out of the realm of possibility?
I wouldn't say so. I think that the Russians also, as you and I discussed a couple of weeks ago, face significant economic and military pressures. They are losing about 1,200, 1,300 men a day, killed and wounded, and moving at a snail's pace through eastern Ukraine. You know, they're losing thousands upon thousands of men to take a few square meters here and there. So they also may feel under some pressure. For me, the key here is how would that deal be enforced? What would be the guarantees received by Ukraine? Right now, European states are seriously discussing the prospect of a military deployment inside Ukraine as a kind of reassurance force. This would be something maybe about division sized, low tens of thousands, maybe deployed to Ukrainian cities, critical infrastructure, nuclear power plants, ports, as a way of guarding against a renewed Russian invasion. But this is the catch. Here's the catch. If America wants a deal like this, it will need to be able to provide a backstop to that European deployment. If it is unwilling to do that, we may have no security guarantees, and a thin, weak, fragile deal that, like the Minsk agreement signed 10 years ago, could collapse in relatively short order. If the American government is willing to provide that backstop, I think that the possibilities are much more expansive than they are today.
A final possibility. What if Trump were to throw his hands up and say, look, you, none of you have come to the table in the way that I want you to, and walks out? In other words, decides that he's not going to bankroll Ukraine in any way or arm Ukraine in any way. What is the immediate consequence of that? Is Europe prepared to actually defend Ukraine in the manner that they need to indefinitely at this stage, if that were to take place?
I think it would cause a serious crisis within Ukraine. They would begin to suffer serious artillery shortages. Europe could make up some of those, but what Europe cannot compensate for entirely is some of the intangible assistance that's being given to Ukraine. For instance, intelligence about Russian aerial attacks using American intelligence assets. Also, things like air defense interceptors. And as those interceptors begin to run dry, you would see Russian air power potentially asserting itself over Ukraine with deadly consequences. Now, here's the thing. Europeans currently provide, Vishnu, about 60% of the aid to Ukraine. Americans provide 40%. You wouldn't know that if you just listened to Donald Trump. So we could keep the Ukrainians in the field for some time. You know, they would be able to get through the year, I believe, without suffering from a sudden a critical collapse. We're not going to see a kind of Kabul in Kiev in the same way. However, there is a limit to this process. We do not have the defense industrial capacity because we simply have not been diligent enough at investing in it over the 3 years of this conflict to keep Ukraine sustained indefinitely. There would be serious and I believe eventually catastrophic implications if America was to cut and run completely.
And that really does bring me to my final question. America cutting and running. If you just take a look at some of J.D. Vance's remarks, right? And you heard them, you were there. And let me just quote, on the internal threat to Europe, the threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external factor. What I worry about is a threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America. This is unthinkable, unthinkable. This is America pulling the rug under Europe's feet. It's challenging the premise of NATO.
I agree. And, you know, last night, Vishnu, I listened to the German election results come in. And Friedrich Merz, who is Germany's presumptive next chancellor, his party has emerged as the biggest in Germany's parliament. It'll need a coalition, but he's the next leader of Germany. He went on German television within hours of winning and said some remarkable things that I have never heard a European leader say in that way. He said, America does not care about the fate of Europe. He said, we need an independent European defense capability. And he said he doesn't even know if NATO will exist in its current form by the time of the NATO summit, which is 3 or 4 months away. These are astonishing things to hear from the mouth of a European leader. And so it isn't about the number of troops in Europe. It isn't about deployments. It's about the psychology of whether America has Europe's back. And all around me, I see a European continent that is reeling with shock, dealing with the aftermath of this and asking itself, what will it take to defend ourselves? 3% of GDP, 4% of GDP? How long will it take? Can we replace American enablers, intelligence, airlift, command and control? Can we replace America's nuclear umbrella? There are quiet conversations taking place amongst Brits, French, and their nuclear arsenals about how they can expand this to the rest of Europe. We really are in the period of the most radical change in European security than at any time in my lifetime, and I suspect at any time since 1945.
Yeah, the Second World War. Shashank, thanks very much for joining us. These are very challenging times, not just for Europe, around the world. What happens next in Ukraine and Russia impacts so many. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
As President Donald Trump reevaluates the United States and how they look at Europe now, and as the talk intensifies on a peace between Russia and Ukraine, I'm joined by Ben Smith, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Semaphore, somebody who's been observing all of these developments. Thanks very much for being with us. First up, just in the last little while, we've had the French president at the White House. Donald Trump wasn't there to greet him. He got out of his car and went in. Now, that seems a bit strange. Do you think, first up, Trump is sending some sort of signal to him, to Macron?
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is sending the same signal to Macron that he's been sending to the Europeans, you know, for years, but certainly in recent weeks, which is basically that they're on their own, that he thinks that they've, you know, that they haven't been paying their taxes to the United States of America, and that he's very skeptical of the Atlantic Alliance.
Do you believe that this is Trump essentially reading the riot act to Europe, that, look, the war in Ukraine has to end now, and you better figure out how you come to the table, because otherwise America is essentially going to pull the plug?
I mean, I think that's the kind of grand strategy version of this. I think, in a way, Trump maybe sees it more as a television show, as theater, as, you know, he's having a big public fight with the Europeans. Maybe in episode 4, there's going to be a reunion, who knows? But right now, he's really pushing them away and has really caused a true crisis in Europe.
I was in Munich a couple of days back for the Munich Security Conference, and I was astounded by what J.D. Vance had to say when he said, and I quote, "The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. What I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values." This is the American vice president speaking to America's closest allies, NATO allies, in this manner. What does that reflect?
I would say it primarily reflects, as politics so often do, American domestic politics. Vance is very, very focused, as the Trump coalition is, on cultural issues inside the United States, on arguments about the media and social media inside the United States. And I think he was giving a speech in Munich that was very much aimed at an American audience and at his base, who loved it, by the way. I mean, it was incredibly well received here in the United States, even as it, I think, really appalled a lot of Europeans who are, you know, in the middle of a shooting war.
Is it your sense that with the change of administration in the United States, there is a genuine belief now that the war must come to an end? Or are those who voted for the Republicans perhaps divided on what America should do as far as Ukraine is concerned?
You know, it's a complicated question, because there is a broad hope in the United States that the war will come to an end. And the administration is very sympathetic to Russia and quite hostile to Ukraine in general, and to Zelensky in particular. And there's real personal history here. Zelensky refused Donald Trump's pressure to help him in an earlier election. It became a huge scandal. The American people are very sympathetic to Ukraine and very unsympathetic to Russia. I think single-digit percentages have any sympathy for Russia in this conflict. And So there's a real gap between where the Trump administration is and where the people of the United States are. But I do think that if Trump can come out and say, look, I brought peace, that's going to be a popular thing to do.
Do you believe Trump doesn't care either way how involved Ukraine or Zelensky is personally in the peace process that he's clearly drafting?
I mean, I think we should take him at his word. He wants to do a deal with Vladimir Putin. I think he likes symmetry. He likes power. He likes the theater of power. And that's what they're arranging for him in Saudi Arabia.
How does America or Trump, let's say, or the Republicans potentially see the rise of the right in Europe? It's not just Germany and the elections which took place yesterday. You've had a very strong statement from the Italian prime minister, and I quote, she said this yesterday, when Bill Clinton and Tony Blair created the global leftist liberal network in the 90s, they were called statesmen. Today, when Trump, Meloni, Milei, or maybe Modi talk, they're called a threat to democracy. This is the left's double standard, but we are used to it. This would be music to Trump's ears, right?
Yeah, and I think she's saying something that really does reflect a huge change between Donald Trump in 2016 and Donald Trump in 2025, which is that Trump has real allies across the world, people who admire him and who see things his way. And they're trying to help. And that includes Meloni in Italy. It includes Orban in Hungary. I think challenge is that they're also trying to help the AfD in Germany. They're trying to help, what are considered far-right parties across Europe. They're trying to help the Reform Party in the UK, which supported Brexit. But one of the quirks of nationalism is that, the American government reaching in and trying to help your nationalist party may not actually help them. And it didn't seem to help the AfD. The AfD's high watermark was right before Elon Musk started cheering for them. And they wound up about where they were before, but he does not seem to have helped them at all. And if anything, his interference seems to have turbocharged the far left in that country. And so I think that, there's a question of whether Trump and Musk, who is substantially less popular than Trump, will actually be able to use their influence to help their allies in Europe, or whether that there will be a backlash to that.
And in terms of what's happened in Germany with the center-right, Christian Democratic Union, coming to power, they'll have to stitch up an alliance. Do you believe that they are under much more pressure to bring an end to this war? Because Germany has traditionally opposed ending the war, despite the fact that they've been importing oil and gas at certain stages from Russia. They've actually wanted to keep the war going. Do you believe that with a new government in place in Germany, once the alliance is stitched together, there would be pressure to end it really fast?
I think Germany does have these historic ties to Russia in recent decades and has been generally more sympathetic to Russia. But I think they see a revanchist Russia pretty close to their eastern borders, rearming with a huge battle-hardened military, and it's a huge security concern for them. And so I think, ending the war is an important goal for them, but they're more worried about permitting a pause in the war on Russia's terms that in 3 to 5 years produces instability in Poland and the Baltic states further into Ukraine. And so I think this likely Chancellor Merz seems to be, signaling that he wants a really strong European support for Ukraine and to pull away from the Atlantic alliance.
And where does this leave Putin? We haven't spoken about Putin at all. Is he just watching on as all of these developments happen around him? The European alliance seems to be disintegrating, at least ideologically. So he just sort of sits there and watches what happens, right? After having made all the right sounds, look, we want peace.
Yeah, I mean, right now it looks like Trump is just playing directly into his hands. And even though he, in fact, launched the invasion of Ukraine, he gets to appear to be the peacemaker. But I think that there's a domestic challenge for Trump that he cannot really push through an outcome that looks like a Russian victory. And in fact, the further he pulls the Russians into peace talks in Saudi Arabia, I think at some point, if he does a deal he likes with the Ukrainians, he will probably turn around and really try to squeeze the Russians. Putin has an incredible history and experience of running circles around American presidents. He's really successfully outmaneuvered a long series of American presidents. And Russia is winning this war right now. And I think he does not feel huge pressure to stop the war. And so you could see those talks falling apart And you could see Trump pushing very hard in those talks. It's very hard to predict.
Could we actually see a situation where Trump just throws his hands up in the air and walks out and says, look, I tried, it isn't happening? It really depends on what Putin chooses to do. Will Putin come to the table in the manner in which he is saying? And if the European alliance backs Ukraine and then creates problems for America and Trump's strategy, could we actually have a scene where Trump says, okay, that's enough now, you deal with Russia, I'm out of it?
You know, I think Trump will be concerned about looking weak in the United States. He doesn't want to be the guy who lost a war. And I think, again, it's going to be very much about his domestic politics and how things appear in the American media and in the kind of conservative media here in the U.S., and that those are really the driving forces for him.
All right. Ben Smith, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Semaphore, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks.